Pulp Arcana, the Vintage Pulp Paperback Morgue.
This is the Pulp Arcanum podcast, latest episode in October 2020. To give a brief intro here, this is the Halloween special compilation featuring three reviews I have for you that I've compiled on three separate recordings. First one, Pranks, the great cover with the pumpkin jaw, you know, the pumpkin, the jack-o'-lantern head from Leisure Books. That's first up. Second up, the Halloween 2018 novelization from Titan Books. And third, lastly, from R.L. Stine, not from Fear Street, not Goosebumps, but from his 1990 Halloween Party book. Also, I have Murder, She Wrote, Trick or Treachery. Stay tuned for that. That's not a review, though. That's going to be a back cover plot review of that. Just a few, you know, Halloween-themed books here and there for short segments. And Young Frankenstein. I also have an excerpt from that coming up randomly. So it's all going to be spaced out in this episode. You got a lot of good variety of pulp goodies spanning several different decades. Enjoy, sit back, listen. And we are back with the Pulp Arcanum podcast. This was JBM. Stay tuned. Based on the Universal Television series, Murder, She Wrote, Trick or Treachery. It's late October in Cabot Cove, and as Halloween approaches, something strange is in the air. The arrival of a self-righteous fire and brimstone spiritual medium has some townspeople on the lookout for curses and evil omens. A reclusive, eccentric woman has others whispering that she is a real-life witch, and the upcoming annual Halloween party has Jessica Fletcher frantically searching for the perfect costume. Then the whole town ends up spooked when the alleged witch ends up dead in the graveyard, and everyone at the party is a suspect. Jessica takes it upon herself to stir through a witch's brew of motives and concocts a scary scheme of her own to make sure a guilty ghoul doesn't get away with murder. Released by Signet in October 2000. Scared to Death, Murder, She Wrote, Trick or Treachery. Halloween, while mortals raise hell, hell vomits up the damned. Pranks by Dennis J. Higman. Its first publishing was in January 1983 through Dorchester Publishing's horror suspense thriller line by Leisure. The cover, noticeably devoid of its Halloween theme, features the floating head of a strangly-haired blonde boy staring at you menacingly. A red blob hovers above him, oozing blood droplets. However, by the early 1990s, Leisure had mastered the art of graphic horror paperback covers and re-released it, magnifying the book's Halloween tenet. Author of the book, Dennis J. Higman, has virtually no ripples in the publishing world outside of Pranks. The only other trace of him on the internet of Dennis J. Higman, the man I found, was in Idaho, where he's facing a fine for failure to register his vehicle. Pierce's date of birth was 1940, which would be in the age range of he was in his early 40s when the book was published. With only a pitiful 2.6 rating on Goodreads, it's the stark splendor of its cover that lifts its fame in horror paperback realm. Its pitch-black canvas accentuates the focal character of the cover. Pranks is slightly arched in gold embossed lettering. An adolescent boy staring at you with sullen eyes is spliced with the falcate shape of a grinning jack-o'-lantern jaw. And to add to the already unsightly horror is an axe plunged into the side of the boy's head with a trail of blood dripping down. Turning it over, the back cover tagline reads, "Trick or treat and die." It was Halloween night and the kids were dressed to kill. All they wanted was a little harmless fun on that foggy October evening. A little revenge against the uptight, solid citizens of Puget Sound who looked down on them. A few overturned garbage cans, a couple of smashed pumpkins, a cherry bomb or two. That was their plan. But as it grew darker and windier, their pranks turned meaner and nastier. Pets died. So did some livestock. And as the storm moved in, the kids were seized by an overpowering force of evil, compelling them to commit fearful acts of violence. Driven by their mindless bloodlust, tormented by forbidden urges, the children of Puget Sound went on a rampage of death and destruction. Murder became their favorite trick, and their victims' only treat was to die quickly. Pranks. From front cover to back cover, they incorporate the colors of Halloween, as that's what they were looking to capitalize on. The gist of that back cover plot is partially true for the first third of the book. There is a Halloween party. There are kids gathering. There's a mixture of middle school kids, as well as the old neighborhood lady who's paranoid and always calling the cops, as well as a family called the Millers who is hosting a Halloween party for all our characters. The mischief of the plot is mostly driven by the main character, Bucky, who is a troublesome young youth who essentially leads a lot of this rampage with his sidekick. The other kids are mostly good. It's set in the Pacific Northwest, and there is a storm rolling in on Halloween night. There's a nice build-up to that. It almost seems like the climax, but you're only about 30 pages into this book at this point. After a few pranks and the power going out, Halloween descends, though, and it's November 1st. With only one death on Halloween night as Bucky kills a local old man on the dock. But there's still hundreds of pages left in the book. And we follow a lot of the adult characters, including Bucky's teacher, who's worried about him being psycho because he's handing in mutilated and gory artwork for his school assignments. We also have a cop getting calls from the neighborhood old lady who's complaining about Bucky riding motorcycles and tipping over cows. In Bucky's reports through the school, it documents his misbehavior, including in September 1977, he received 5 paddles. This good son type of shenanigans continues. He's the son of a rapist, as his mom ended up having his rape child. So the bad blood is betwixt them. Based on a lot of the other reviews that I see, they came to this book, like me, seeking certain elements of horror and Halloween that the book did not deliver. The prose is readable, but overall the storytelling and suspense is amateurish. I'd say if there were more of a demonic element where the whole posse of rascals joined in on the mayhem, and it strictly stuck to Halloween and played up those themes, it would have overall been a better book. A book often confused with pranks is David Robbins' Prank Night. That's David Robbins of the End World series and contributor to other popular men's adventure novels of the 80s and early 90s. Final grade for me is a C-. Only a modicum of enjoyment can be gleaned from this. This has been a Pulp Arcanum segment from our Halloween podcast special compilation. Search your podcast app for the full episode. Halloween 2018 from Titan Books, the official movie novelization by John Passarella. In 1978, Laurie Strode survived an encounter with Michael Myers, a masked figure who killed her friends and terrorized the town of Haddonfield, Illinois, on Halloween night. Myers was later gunned down, apprehended, and committed to Smiths Grove State Hospital. For 40 years, memories of that nightmarish ordeal have haunted Laurie, and now Myers is back once again on Halloween night, having escaped a routine transfer, leaving a trail of bodies in his wake. This time, Laurie is prepared, with years of survival training to protect herself, her daughter Karen, and her granddaughter Allison, a teenager separated from her family and enjoying Halloween festivities. The film was adapted into novelized form and released the same month in October 2018 by former Horror Writers Association Bram Stoker Award winner John Passarella. Other media tie-ins by him include Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Supernatural, two horror TV series. Coming in at 371 pages, it's a hefty novelization, giving introspectives on each character. Like many other novelizations, it gives us various expansions in spots and scenes. What makes this one top-notch is he really puts a lot of meat on the bones of what he was given, whereas some other novelizations are a skimpy go-along ride, not veering too much far off the script and inside the character's mind, where this expands on that. From the opening scene, the decay and filth of Smith's Grove is felt. From the start, Dr. Sartain's motives are expressed more intimately. As a former student of Dr. Loomis at the University of Illinois, his obsession over Michael Myers is clear. The sentiment of Michael's departure is poignant for Sartain, for the mysteries of Myers are still unknown. Soon he'll be transferred to Glass Hill, Colorado, around Halloween. Aaron and Dana play a tape recording of Dr. Loomis, dated January 22, 1979, in which Loomis is recommending termination of Mike. The state of Illinois no longer desires to examine Michael Myers and have signed him over to a private security in Colorado. In a scene not shown in the movie, Michael Myers is shackled in anticipation of his transfer night. Sartain gets on the bus, apologizing to Michael for being late. A scene thankfully cut from the movie was when Aaron dons the Michael Myers mask naked in the hotel room as the podcasters hook up. Haddonfield High School, their nickname is the Huskers, the Haddonfield Huskers, and their school colors are blue and yellow. You might recall the scene where they visit Judith Myers' gravestone at Haddonfield Cemetery. Then briefly, the caretaker actually sees Michael Myers off in the distance. He's still in his asylum whites. And another unique thing about this novel is they have the perspective of Michael Myers. They'll do these italic print paragraphs from Michael Myers' vantage point. Not his thoughts or anything, just his movements. Describing the shape, you know, sidling through the bushes and whatnot. Dr. Sartain explains how Michael escaped to the police. He overtook the first guard, causing the bus to crash. He then chained Sartain and left him. Officer Hawkins is able to give a little tidbit on Haddonfield in the 40 years since the Michael Myers murders, including that the Michael Myers house became an object of attraction for serial killer groupies and death metal bands. It's now a community garden, as it was torn down by a non-profit organization. That explains why it really isn't featured in the movie. Lori's trauma is delved into deeply, and her tragic and traumatic relationship with her daughter is also fleshed out more in the novel than it is in the book. The ending of the movie shows a scene of Michael Myers burning in the cellar, as you might remember. In the novel, it's described that Michael's hands start burning, then the mask boils from the intense heat of the fire, presumably destroying it. Then his whole body is engulfed by the flames, but it leaves off saying that the shape struggles. Watching the movie and reading the book, there's a lot of teenage trauma with Allison, that would be Lori's daughter, and her friends, that just comes off as not too funny the more you watch it and reading it. All in all, it's an exceptional movie novelization. The deaths are in great detail, and he's able to savor them for multiple paragraphs. It isn't skimmed over in any way. The history of movie novelizations in the Halloween franchise is very rich. The unanimous king of horror movie novelizations has to be Halloween by Curtis Richards, released a year after the film's smashing success in 1979. Being out of print and never republished since then, even tattered copies routinely go for $100. Released by Bantam Books, the alternate cover and more sought-after one has to be the jack-o'-lantern head featuring him clutching the knife that's bleeding in white robes. Wrapping up my thoughts on the Halloween 2018 novelization, the most compelling aspect of the Halloween franchise to me is the study case of evil as the asylum doctor chases after his patient on the dark streets on a Halloween night, and that atmosphere. The sick curiosity of Dr. Sartain wanting to witness Michael Myers unleashed and free from the confinement of Smith's Grove is the driving force in this movie. The juxtaposition of those two characters is most intriguing, as they both construct and stir the hysteria that is evil incarnate Michael Myers, the boogeyman. Although I wasn't too much of a fan of the film outside of Dr. Sartain, this book is really genuine. My only criticism would be that I feel Dennis Etchison did a tremendous job describing Halloween in his novelizations, part 2 and 3. You really felt the holiday, the darkness in the air, the cold wind, the festivities, the ornaments. Whereas John Passarella, he did a great job describing Smith's Grove, and I thought he was going to be great at describing Halloween. But I felt like he didn't do enough to describe what an Illinois Halloween really felt like in terms of ambiance. A- is my final grade, with a high recommendation. If you're not into horror movie novelizations, this is one to step into and seek out. This has been a Pulp Arcanum segment by JBM. I, Buford Frankenstein, in this my 83rd year of life, do hereby declare the following statements as my last will and testament to be read on the occasion of my 100th birthday. The once proud name of Frankenstein has been dragged by my only son, Victor, into an abyss of shame. There was a time when the name Frankenstein conjured dreams of virtue. Now no misery can be found equal to mine, unless my only male heir, my great-grandson Frederick, whom I have never seen, but who is, at the time of this recording, 10 years of age and residing in America with my granddaughter Catherine, has, by his own free will, embraced medicine as his career and has acquitted himself with some measure of esteem. Then, to him, I leave everything. Young Frankenstein. A novel by Gilbert Perlman, based on the screenplay by Gene Wilder and Mel Brooks, published by Ballantine Books in December 1974.
I had another bookmark abandoned Fear Street. And this time it was Halloween Party from 1990, R.L. Stine. I picked up three R.L. Stine Halloween themed paperbacks this month, October 2015. The other two, I'm going to read these and review these. Halloween Night and Halloween Night 2. Halloween Night 2 was actually one of the first R.L. Stine books I ever received back in the 90s, back in the day. I'm just going to read the back of the book synopsis, so you get a feel for the setting, then I'll give opinions on it and spoilers as we go. So, the invitation arrived in a black bordered envelope. Inside, the card showed a coffin with the inscription, "Reserved for You." It was perfectly fitting for an all-night Halloween party on Fear Street, but Terry and his girlfriend Nikki wondered why they had been invited. They barely knew Justine Cameron, the beautiful and mysterious transfer student who was throwing the party. The party was well underway when the lights went out. That's to be expected at a spooky Halloween party. But when the lights came back on, there was that boy on the floor with a knife in his back. Just a Halloween prank? Maybe. Maybe not. For Terry and Nikki, the trick-or-treating has turned to terror. To their horror, they realize that someone at the costume party is dressed to kill. Oh, and this party was a killer. And the kills, well, let's just say it's not plural. Yeah, from the opening chapter, I was really captivated. They start off in the cemetery. So this party takes place on Cameron Mansion. And that's at the end of the cul-de-sac on Fear Street. Yes, there is a cul-de-sac on Fear Street at the end. Did you know that it was a dead road? And what's at the end of it? Only fitting an ancient forgotten cemetery that they have to pass through. So this mansion was built with no driveway, apparently, and the only way to get there. Everyone had to park their cars at the end of the cul-de-sac and walk through the cemetery. So it's an awesome opening chapter. He starts off right in there. Howling wind. Moss-covered gravestones, kids in masks, costumes. Yeah, it's pretty awesome. Then he jumps back to the invitations, and we get to introduce all the characters. And I have to say, this was just a snafu of characters. This is what really held it back. Most of the times in the Fear Street novel, since they're so minuscule in size, that he limits the characters to only few. He'll have the likable girl next door protagonist, who she's so innocent, and she just contends with the bitchy girl from school and her boyfriend, who's kind of nice but still kind of mean. And then you'll have the best friend, who usually ends up being the killer, right? Anyway, so then he jumps back to that, and it's just really silly, and all these characters are silly, and the whole thing was really puerile throughout. And the characters, like I said, you don't really get inside their heads. You only learn about one line of who they are. It'll be like, oh, Trisha's just Terry's friend. And our two protagonists, it's kind of a sharing, but Terry is really the lead. This girl on the cover is Nikki, which is Terry's girlfriend. And Terry was just, I hated him. He was just a total beta. He was total wimp and a whiner. and he was jealous of this other guy who used to be Nikki's ex-boyfriend. It's just really bad. And the girl who holds the party, Justine, she's the classic hot girl. Hot, mysterious. She invites... Why is she so strict on the number 9 guess? Oh yeah, you can guess it. It's a revenge plot. Should I get into spoilers now? Actually, let me say... Yeah, they do this whole thing where it's jocks versus nerds, and then they throw bullies into it. There's even motorcycles that get driven into the mansion like Animal House. It's so bad. I don't even know what R.L. Stine was thinking. It's like... They just threw everything except for a black cat in there. So... The party goes on, they have this contest between jocks and nerds, and why don't I just pretty much sum this up? I'm going to get to spoilers now. I mean, that's what you come to when you come to a book review, let's face it. Terry and Nikki grow suspicious of there being some kind of killer. Oh yeah, there's total pranks, obviously. Everyone's faking their death left and right. And then you know how R.L. Stine's really known for his cliffhanger chapter endings. You can always tell when they're fake or someone... Or he'll describe a zombie, but you know it's a mask. There's no supernatural elements in this. There's no flying jack-o'-lantern in the cemetery that you see right here. There's none of that at all. It's a murder whodunit mystery, kind of Clue style. It's kind of in a theme that's really been done excessively. And it's really not that great because the whole plot is Justine's like a 28-year-old woman who came back to Shadyside just to live in the mansion and get revenge on this Halloween night. She had it all planned out. She was fit. She was like, I studied gymnastics when I was a teenager. She ends up locking them all in there, trying to incinerate them and set the whole mansion on fire. She ends up being a real crazy bitch. You don't even really know who any of these characters are as they're saying it. They might as well all be the same. It's like Murphy, he's the football player. Les, he's a geek. Alex, he's the former ex-boyfriend. I didn't know. Trisha, she's the mother hen. You didn't know? She's about to die, but I don't care because I don't have sympathy for him. I'm not cold. Anyway, Justine, her parents died in a car crash caused by all these kids' parents 28 years ago. Justine gave up her life, her perfect... jet-setting, globe-trotting, and husband gave up that lifestyle just to come back to act as a teenager and get revenge with these pathetic bunch of losers. Revenge plot. Anyway, B-. I think I pretty much said everything I had to say. Click on the channel for more R.L. Stine book reviews and vintage horror.
Pulp Arcanum is a podcast featuring content and discussions on the pulp fiction genres of 20th century literature. Horror, adventure, fantasy, and sci-fi. The fantastical stories published in the 1920s pulp magazines ignited the era with an explosion of strange and weird tales. To participate in upcoming Skull Sessions on the podcast, email me directly at pulparcanum@gmail.com. That's pulparcanum. For Facebook, there's a page, Pulp Arcanum Podcast. Also, many paperback collection photos are featured on the Instagram.